You're listening to Ship History Radio from the Steamship Historical Society of America. Through recording, preserving, and educating, our mission is to share the impact of engine-powered vessels, their crews, and their passengers with future generations. My name is Amy Bacharya, and I am the Education Director. Here with me today is Daniel Harrington, a former East Providence Council member who began researching the Larchmont disaster and has been touring local libraries and historical societies with his hour-long presentation on this horrific Rhode Island tragedy. You can learn more about our organization at sshsa.org. Thank you for joining us here today. Can you tell us a bit about your background, maybe a little about your history tour, and how you came to research this subject?
Sure can, Amy. It all came to me quite oddly and somewhat coincidentally. After writing a couple of letters to the editor in 2013, Ed Acorn at that time asked me to become a columnist. Now, I had a history. I called myself a recovering politician. I was a councilman in East Providence. So I started writing monthly columns, focusing on history, Rhode Island history, trying not to pigeonhole myself. Long story short, I did a piece on the Larchmont because it fascinated me while reading a history book of Rhode Island. And I did 115 near consecutive pieces for the journal. Throughout the time, there was one piece that haunted me more than anything. It's the Larchmont, which simply means I did more research. And an interesting tell on that is my piece was late to the journal that month on the Larchmont. I started here in the Steamship Society with my research because the miracle that occurred in that story and the survivors of zero-degree weather seemed to me unbelievable. And so what I did is I delayed and I researched it, and then I said, wow, this is amazing, and I did the story. Fast forward a couple years, a local historical society asked me to do a lecture, and I chose the Larchmont, and I was amazed with the people's response to it. So I said, wow, this PowerPoint is good. Let me improve it and ask several libraries to go along, and they did. Historical societies jumped on the way. I improved it. I researched harder, scrubbed some more microfilm, took pictures of the actual places and the buildings, which are still there, and cobbled together a one-hour presentation that seems to be doing very well because it's highly entertaining and true to my tagline, which is, Larchmont makes the Titanic look like a Disney flick. So,
well, everybody likes a good maritime disaster story, you know?
That's why you're in business.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about what travel would have been like at the time? This was 1907. Did people use ships primarily for leisure? Was it point A to point B, a little bit of both?
I think the best way to answer that question is to look at those old photographs and don't say, boy, that's how they did in the olden days. These were exciting times. Late Industrial Revolution. A steamship in Providence or Fall River, if you had some dough, was a great, exciting way of travel. Think of new technology. Think of Apple 2.0. It was steamship. It was the train 2.0. It was an alternative, slightly cheaper, to get on a steamship. It was sexy. You could eat at night, go to sleep, wake up in the morning. You could get a private room. So usually it was a dollar for the ticket, a dollar for a private stateroom. Otherwise, you slept in the dormitory-style berths. Oof. So it was a little bit pragmatic and practical, but it was a little bit the exciting thing to do. We've made it. We are now industrialized. We have money. Let's take the kids to New York. Let's go see our relatives. And the reasons behind people going were just as diverse as the people themselves.
Okay. And so specific, I guess, to the Larchmont, now who would have been on that ship that day and where were they headed?
So the ship was headed to New York from Providence. One of the heroes on the Larchmont was here for a professional organization, a society, like a JC's or a Kiwanis. Weddings were big, coming in two weddings. Education, dreams. There was a young man on the Larchmont who was a failed, he was from Pawtucket, and he was a failed farmer, and he was going to New York seeking funds. Mm. So not unlike today, why are you going to the big city? There's something I need. There was some pleasure, but think of it mostly purposeful, business, moving. There was a Sicilian musician who was going back to Sicily through New York because New England weather was just too darn cold. So you name it, they were on there. And there was a big part of transients. people looking for jobs in New York or to Providence.
Okay. So can you give us a bit of background about the ship? What happened to the ship and why is it so important to Rhode Island history?
Yes, it was one of the greatest, most horrific disasters in Rhode Island. The chief reason is that for 1 week in February of 1907, the entire world watched the Larchmont and looked at Rhode Island and heard about it. So the Larchmont, the brief history is, it was a cursed ship. They called it the Hoodoo Boat. Why? Larchmont started life as the Cumberland out of Maine, and its service was going from Boston to New Brunswick. Think Irish immigrants. And then one day it hit a banana boat, literally, called the Admiral Farragut, and it started to sink, and the Cumberland barely makes it back to Boston Harbor. So they declared a total loss.
Wow.
And then they sell it for scrap. And the Joy Line Company of Providence buys it. They didn't total it. They repaired it and repainted it and stuck a new name on it called the Larchmont.
Okay.
So they put it into service right away, fill it up with people, and then it starts. It runs aground off Prudence Island. It catches fire off the Bronx. It runs aground again off Warwick Neck. And then, 1 year before the disaster, a man named John A. Hart of Providence is shot in the head and robbed while coming home from New York City. Of course, the crime is never solved. So folks everywhere started calling it the cursed ship, the Hoodoo Boat. And that was before the fateful day of February 11th, 1907.
Wow. So you wonder why people even got on it if it was so cursed. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about what the weather was like that day.
More than anything else, Amy, the weather is why we're talking about the Larchmont. New England weather is usually 30 degrees, 25 degrees. For some reason, there was a blizzard in Providence 1 week earlier, and they were still digging out. But the temperature the night the Larchmont sailed to New York was 2 degrees below zero. And the wind was gusting to 50 miles per hour. So it was the determining factor in turning a sea accident into one of America's most horrific accidents ever. It put an ice coating of 7 inches on the bodies that went down with the ship. So 0 degrees, but still they sailed. They were 1 hour delayed, but still they sailed.
Wow.
Here's one thing you have to learn about the Larchmont, everybody. The visibility was absolutely clear.
Mm.
There's no problem seeing that night. It was human error.
Wow.
We'll get into that.
So why did they decide to go out in weather like that? Was there not regulations or anything at the time that would stop them? It was just sort of up to the captain's discretion?
Great question. Perfect question, Amy. You've got to think of steamship protocol, and the law was still the Wild Wild West. It was a fairly new technology. And if there were bodies on that boat, there was money to be made, and the ship sailed. And those people wanted to go to their destinations. They were hardy people.
Yeah.
They're not going to let 20 degrees cooler than normal to keep them from a wedding or appointment, or as one kid was, a runaway. He was going to get to his new destination. So yes, they were very liberal. The Larchmont is noted for being the last ship to go down without a passenger manifest outside of the ship. So the law today that passenger manifests must be kept outside the vessel started because the Larchmont didn't have one. We don't know how many people went down with the ship.
Wow.
So yes, the laws were very lax.
That was actually my very next question, so that was a good segue. I was going to say, do we know how many people died or how many people were on board that day?
No, and we never will, but I will tell you a fact that's most important to tell. The official estimates are between 140 and 160 people, give or take, including the crew. But Quartermaster James Staples died in 1959, many years after the Larchmont went down, and on his deathbed he confessed that no fewer than 332 souls perished that night. He never let that information out because he feared repercussions from the steamship authority that investigated the accident, things like overcrowding or the disaster and the limited amount of lifeboats. So I believe that number may have been high, maybe 322 minus the crew. So I believe 300 people perished that night.
Wow. And can you talk about how these people died? I know you mentioned some of them were covered in 7 inches of ice.
It's a trifecta of horror. You ready?
Yes.
The ship collided with a Harry Knowlton, a sailboat. But the problem was the Knowlton struck a bullseye. It hit the main steam engine and released instantly huge clouds of toxic steam into the ship. So the first round of people suffocated or had their throats burned to death.
Oh.
The ship started filling up with icy water at about 2 feet per minute. Fast enough to convince you of your doom, but slow enough to let you sink in all the horror of it. Some were trampled to death. It was also total dark. The Harry Knowlton took out the generator, so it was pitch black, so it was panic there. Those that made it up to the upper deck started freezing immediately. The wind-driven waves by the 50-mile-an-hour winds made instant white skin out of every extremity and frostbite and instant pain, causing people to voluntarily go into the water and die. Those that went into the water were frozen, as you said, with 7 inches of ice on them, with their hands frozen in the position of clutching whatever they could. Many died with their hands frozen over their ears.
Wow.
And yes, there were suicides. Men slit their throats, and there were murder. As men tried to get into the boat, they were stabbed or pierced with boat hooks.
Oh my goodness.
So there was everything.
I noticed in your presentation you talked about the cause of death was listed as drowning for everybody, but it's clearly that wasn't the cause of death.
So yes, actually.
Why did they do that?
This is a favorite question. So all of the bodies, about 50 bodies went to Block Island, mercifully, and not out to sea. And there was one chief doctor and municipal official on Block Island named Dr. Champlin. And he immediately rules all bodies, including the survivors, remain overnight for examination. And then he then capriciously declared that all the dead died of freezing. All of them.
Okay.
Not drowning, not
freezing.
Blunt trauma,
yeah.
Not suicide. Now, in my lectures, I've been pretty hard on good old Dr. Champlin because he kept the survivors overnight instead of sending them to Rhode Island Hospital immediately.
Yeah.
But I've been tempered in my criticism by audience members who told me, remember, 114 years ago, you put suicide on someone's death certificate. That means a lot in the community and for burial arrangements in the church. It was a big deal.
Yeah.
You put murder on a death certificate. That has insurance company implications. So I believe Dr. Champlin simply said they all froze to death as a process that probably predates good crisis management and wanting to take control of an ugly situation and just unite these people in a common cause of death, which was ultimately the weather. He didn't get it wrong.
Right.
And but it was a pretty bold move.
Yeah. Are there any sort of specific cases or people on board, stories that are really interesting that you'd like to share?
The story centers around the ill-fated ship's captain named George McVeigh, who was the captain of the Larchmont when it went down, although he wasn't at the controls, that was Pilot Anson. McVeigh's career starts when he's a young kid. He's 23, and he's got control of a steamship called the Tremont. And it, unfortunately, due to a cook, catches fire in New York City. But McVeigh becomes a hero at 23 by pulling 43 people out of the flames, mostly crew members, and he's celebrated as a hero. And it's funny because the press said that that disaster was noted for two lions fighting the firefighters. But while the lions were on the boat, they died due to smoke inhalation. There was no fight with the firefighters. But the real story not reported was Captain McVeigh actually saved a baby lion cub and came out of the fire. So he was on the top of the world and he impressed his corporate betters. So how perfect, and when he turns 28, the Larchmont comes into Providence, formerly the Cumberland, and they ask him to be the captain of his very first steamship. So Captain McVeigh is on his way. And then the disaster happens and fate treats him poorly because he's the first in a lifeboat. What the press did to him after the Larchmont disaster was amazing, that he stayed sane and didn't commit suicide himself. I mean,
wow.
There were preachers on him, people on him, the government was on him. And they eventually said McVeigh was neither censorable nor commendable for his actions. Meaning when he got in the lifeboat, his attention was to find survivors once his own lifeboat was in the water.
Wow.
So then, 18 years after the Lachmont disaster, McVeigh returns to the steamship industry, captains a ship called the Mackinac out of Pawtucket, which steams to Newport, and her boiler explodes, killing 55 people by a scalding steam. Sound familiar?
Ugh.
And McVeigh is the captain of his second ship.
Wow.
He lost 55 lives this time. So he is forever forbidden to have a license that allows him to haul passengers.
Wow.
Even though he wasn't not at fault for any of the tragedies. So the Lachmont, he wasn't steering the ship when it came to the crisis. Pilot Anson was. But still, by putting himself in a lifeboat, that doomed his career.
Yeah.
Because he saved himself first, or at least the optics were.
Wow.
So McVeigh is probably the most compelling story of superstition, coincidence, ill-fated. It's really, you can't make it up.
Yeah. So how did you research this topic? The stories you're sharing are very vivid descriptions. Maybe you can talk a little bit about how you put this whole presentation together.
I've been waiting for that question because the question is a help to anybody doing similar work. I learned that the internet has plenty on the Lachmont, but it is plenty of the same thing repeated on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And what really made the Lachmont come to life for me was the old-fashioned microfilm, going back to the newspapers. Photojournalism was just beginning. And the Boston Globe really took to this story, as the Providence Journal did, but the Globe brought an army of photographers down. And so the images were graphic, they were timely, they brought you into the article. And there was a lot of copying because it was a world article. There was extreme weather, horrific craft, cowardice, frozen bodies. Block Island became a stage of the rescue where the whole island woke up. And because of that, there's stories within the stories and they're all in the press, but it's tricky. It's microfilm, it's newspapers.com. I've actually went to eBay and had people send me actually decaying original documents.
Wow.
And there's where the stories, and you've got to be careful because, for instance, Captain McVeigh's name is spelled MC, capital B-A-Y, but it became McVeigh, V-E-Y, McVeigh, all one word, and you multiply that by the passengers and the reporters were only trying to get a story, and they'd say, Amy, what was your last name? And you say Jones, they say Bones, and similar stuff. So you have to dig, check, recheck. But the writing was splendid. It was graphic. It was humorous. For example, they said Hygercell was a kid who came to Block Island and knocked on a door, and he started the rescue efforts. He became a survivor. But the journal said Hygercell was a German boy who was unusually bright for a lad of that nationality.
Oh, jeez.
And you find wonderful quotes like that. One of the survivors was a man named Filardi, and the journal said he's an Italian who speaks with an Italian's characteristic gesticulations.
Yeah.
And they called the Jewish folks. He was in a boat. He survived in a boat with a Hebrew. So the paper was shockingly politically incorrect and graphic. But fortunately for the lecturer, this makes for great copy and makes audiences laugh. The greatest laugh line of my lecture, and there's not many, but it's when I say that Hygercell was unusually bright for a lad of that nationality. People love that stuff.
Yeah, it's crazy how they would have reported things back then, and that's just accepted. It was like okay to speak like that about these different communities. You know, I find that interesting.
Yeah, so there's no such thing as a tabloid newspaper, is my conviction. They're all tabloid. They always were and they always will be. So we should feel a little better about our more polite society.
Yeah.
That's the good news. They think we're bad now. We're not. They were just as bad then.
I did have a question that there's something I discovered recently that I thought was really fascinating, which was the General Slocum disaster, which was a few years earlier. And the reason I found that so interesting is I'm a sea swimmer. And one of the most famous female sea swimmers, the first woman to swim the English Channel, was a German immigrant in New York at the time. And her mother saw this tragedy, which was mostly German immigrants, lots of women and children. And it wasn't so bad of a, like, they were close enough to the shore that people could have swam to safety, but women were not allowed to swim at that time. And so, I mean, I know this is sort of a different case. Do you think that would have been the case in this tragedy as well? Or I guess you can talk a bit about how the women fared.
So your point on the Slocum is good in that women were acknowledged by a society as being the fairer sex and in need of more help. And that certainly was true on the Watch Mount. But the horror of it was the men completely ignored that, didn't care. And what was wrong with the men? Were they a bunch of evil guys? No, it was the extreme weather. The suddenness of the tragedy turned everybody, male and female, into monsters and selfish beasts. And that's the horror of the Loch Mount. We see lifeboats full of men.
Wow.
And we see one little boy saying, there's a woman out there, let's save her. And they're like, give me the oars, we're not saving anybody. So they watched women drown. So chivalry died early on that. And it was due to the extremes. However, that said, one part of my lecture is wonderful, is that a man named Harris Feldman and seven other people survived on a part of the Loch Mount called the Hurricane Deck. And he did so by making sure the men on the Hurricane Deck were assigned to the women on the Hurricane Deck and physically keep them awake rather than falling asleep all throughout the night. So he was just the opposite. He took chivalry as an honor and as a purpose, and he was a noble man. They weren't all bad, but most were terrible.
Well, actually, that's a good segue, because I was going to ask a bit about the rescue, and there was a ship that came to the aid. Was it the Elsie?
Correct.
So maybe you can just talk about the rescue and how many people died, how many they were able to save.
The rescue is the greatest miracle you've never heard of. What happened when the Loch Mount sank is a section of the Loch Mount, essentially the roof of five cabins, broke free and floated. And 30 people were assembled on this. They all started freezing to death instantly. Yet one man, Harris Feldman, and his wife, Bertha, gathered on that deck, and Sadie Golub, a pretty young belle from Boston, came on that deck. She happened to be a Jewish girl, like Feldman, and heard Feldman talking to his wife in Hebrew and said, save me, I'm a Jewish girl too. Yeah. And Feldman said, you will be saved if I am saved. Meanwhile, an acrobat, tall and handsome from New Hampshire named Sam Lacombe, also came down. We find out later he was only in his underwear and bare feet.
Wow.
A man named David Fox, who was coming back from a Bible conference, and two or three other people. And Feldman starts seeing his wife going under. She starts falling asleep. So he starts to beat her. And that's just what I say, and the audience revolts when I say that, but he starts striking her on the face and then the body. He did not stop the drubbing for 10 minutes. And then she wakes up and he says, my spirit is revived. So he starts telling the others. He tells Sam Lacombe, wake up the girl, Sadie Golub. Don't let her out of your sight. When she starts falling asleep, beat her. Do not lie down with the dead. Keep moving. He tells the Bible, the guy coming back from a Bible conference, to start praying. Keep praying out loud all night. Keep moving. And through this odd, almost miraculous behavior, they stay alive. Yet, unlike the bodies that floated a Block Island, the hurricane deck passes Block Island. Feldman's waving a shirt of a dead man. Nothing sees him. So even Feldman concedes after 12 hours, most people lasted 30 minutes in the zero-degree weather. They lasted 12 hours. Wow. They were all frostbitten, but they stayed alive because they kept miraculously moving. Feldman's ready to give up hope. And then through the fog, they see the fishing schooner Elsie coming through. The Elsie was a Block Island boat on patrol for a retrieval operation to pick up dead people. And the kid, the nephew of the captain, the Elsie, sees the hurricane deck and he says, his uncle was the captain. He says, Captain, there's something floating out there, dead bodies. And as he gets closer to it, he gets hysterical. Dad, they're moving. So that's impossible. You can survive any a half hour on that thing out there. And sure enough, the LC gets right into action, releases two dories, pulls the frozen people from the deck, and ultimately they all survive except for the acrobat Sam Lacombe.
Wow.
His whole body's frozen, even his back. And
that's because he was in his underwear.
Yeah, he succumbs 2 days later on Valentine's Day.
Oh.
But here's the hook. Three times during the night, he personally pulls Sadie Golub, the young belle from Boston, off the edge of the hurricane deck as waves were going to wash her off, and saves her, soaking him anew each time.
Oh.
So there is a story that bests Titanic. You can have your Jack and Rose. I'll have my Sam and Sadie. Because Sam literally saved her life three times at the expense of him freezing to death.
Wow. Oh, that's a nice story. Do you know what happened to some of the survivors after?
Yes, most of them disappeared into, there was seven or eight, most of the crew members kept quiet, except for James Staples, who confessed on the deathbed about the 332 people. We talked about McVeigh and his tragic life. Sadie Golub ended up marrying someone in New Bedford, and she became somewhat of a press star. On her gravestone, it says, last survivor of the Larchmont, and features an etching on her gravestone of herself alone on the hurricane deck.
Wow.
It's the closest thing we have to a Larchmont memorial. So she lived to be 68 years old and became kind of known as the Larchmont. Feldman, the greatest hero of a 20th century shipwreck, just disappears into the he and his wife moved to Chicago, lived a normal life, and his great-grandchildren remember him. So Sam Lacombe died and was buried, but that's it. Most of them are not remembered, with the exception of McVeigh, because he became infamous after the Mackinac tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And his family has had a long tradition of having captains of steamboats to this day. I served on East Providence City Council with the great nephew of Captain McVeigh, whose name was Howard McVeigh, and he was a steamship captain in East Providence for years.
Wow.
And he knows all about the tragedy, so it's a very Rhode Island thing.
I noticed that there was talk that a lot of the survivors were crew members, more so than passengers. Is that true, and why would that be the case?
It's the greatest ugly truth of the sinking of the Larchmont. Reason number one, McVeigh gave the order for the crew to man their life stations, and only four of the eight lifeboats get in the water, so most of them fled. Most of the crew members were saved in one boat, which was McVeigh's boat, and it was the first in. So there's the irony, the captain's boat first in.
Yeah.
I'm going to go in the water, and then I'm going to save some passengers.
Yeah.
The guy who was steering the ship at the time it collided, pilot Anson, went down with the ship. It was his fault for the accident, but to his credit, he was last seen helping passengers. How did they survive in lifeboats when other passengers in lifeboats washed up on Block Island, dead and frozen? The crew members had their winter gear. And they were in tough shape. They were frostbitten, and they couldn't walk, and they collapsed once they reached Block Island the next morning. But because they had their winter garments on and not their nightgowns and underwear, they made it.
We have a postcard from the tragedy that is just pictures of the dead bodies.
Yes.
Frozen on Block Island. Why would they have postcards like that? Is it just an interesting story, or was it so popular that people would want something like that? It seems like an odd...
You're warm there, Amy.
Yeah.
So I have a joke that didn't go over too well in my early presentations that says the postcard was not the picture of the postcard with all the dead bodies. Horrible. It was not so you could write on the back, wish you were here, or
yeah,
thinking of you, right? That was my stale joke. Here's the deal. We've got to remember that in a very big way, postcards in this Industrial Revolutionary period were the new technology of the day. This was the social media of the day. They were there to send not glad tidings, but hard news. And that is why you would put your address on the back of this card and say, you've heard about the Larchmont, I'm going to send you. So people wanted this. This was photojournalism through the mail. So yes, it is odd that we see these. Thank goodness they're still there, because these mementos help recreate the story in a very vivid way. But yeah, they were a for-profit. It was an arm of the newspapers.
Okay. It's interesting.
Crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. I noticed that a lot of people compare this disaster to the Titanic. Even you mentioned that a bit previously. Why do you think that is?
The reason most people compare this to Titanic is Rhode Islanders, because it's our disaster, and the Lachmann occurred 5 years before the Titanic, so we were first, but Titanic became larger than life with the movie a generation ago by James Cameron, and it became such a worldwide phenomena, and therefore the name stuck, but local authors call it. So part of my passion is not to have the Lachmann be diminished by Titanic. And I say to my audience members, Rhode Islanders, stop calling Lachmann Rhode Island's Titanic. Titanic was England's Lachmann. You see, the Lachmann actually had on board, the greatest story never told was Swedish Salvationists. These were 10 Salvationists. These were Salvation Army cadets, seven of which were women, who, when the ship started sinking, took a vow to help the passengers and assist them and not seek to save their own life. As the ship finally went down, the seven Salvationists took each other's hands, got on their knees, and sang, "Nearer, my God, to thee." Sound familiar? 5 years later, the crew, the musicians on the Titanic would do the very thing. You see, the Salvation Army was an English organization. Mm. At the funeral for the Lachmann Salvationists that went down at Carnegie Hall in New York to 10,000 people, 5,000 inside, 5,000 to 10,000 people outside, Ava Booth of England eulogized the Salvationists. And all of Great Britain was stunned and horrified by the tragedy off Rhode Island. Mm. So, 5 years later, I'm sure the musicians on that ship called Titanic said, "Come on, boys, remember the Salvationists on the Lachmann." Wow. So that is personal for me, that the Lachmann is not Rhode Island's Titanic. Titanic is Europe's Lachmann.
I know that, you know, when the Titanic happened, it had a big impact on legislation, lifeboat legislation and things like that. Did anything like that happen with the Lachmann locally? Did it change any rules for steamships?
The most indelible one was that the Lachmann was the case where passenger lists or manifests had to be kept separate from the vessel. Of all things, that was the most frustrating for the investigators. We still don't know how many people were on the Lachmann because that simple rule wasn't in place. And so now, because the Lachmann disaster, passenger lists are to be kept separate from the ship. It would play a part in eventually securing the proper ratio of passengers to lifeboats, which was better by Titanic days, but certainly not to the place. Well, why wasn't the Lachmann more influential in changing laws or changing protocol in the industry? Well, you have to remember that the downside of those early industrial days were steamship accidents were ubiquitous. Train crashes were common. In fact, my research on the Lachmann in New York stops because they had a train crash about a week later that sucked it right off the pages. So this was the time. So I think it took ultimately the collective total of all these accidents to eventually change laws. I say in humility that I haven't researched the legal side, what happened after, because I'm still chasing the passengers, who remain a big mystery to me.
Yeah.
So I'm probably not the best source on the legal ramifications.
Well, those stories of the passengers, I think, are more interesting. It brings a human element to it.
Absolutely.
So can you tell people where they might find information on talks that you're giving? Do you have a Facebook page or a website? Where
yes, I was slow to get I still do not have a dedicated website because the tour kind of came about so fast. I started reaching out to libraries and again. So yes, Facebook, I'm Daniel Harrington. You can find me on Facebook and friend me. I have a updated schedule on there. I think we're going to go right till the end of the year. We keep adding historical societies. We keep adding more libraries. There seems to be a hunger for it. I'm trying to get up to Maine, where the Latch Mount was constructed, and things like this. My email is a source of one of the jokes of the presentation. I say, folks, if you hear anything on the Latch Mount or have a referral for this presentation, email me at danielfharrington@yahoo.com. As one attendee said, my email address is as old as the Latch Mount. I have a Yahoo email address, but that's kind of cool. It's got a cachet to it. So it's danielfharrington@yahoo.com. And my attendees have been great, sending me photos, sending me stories, relatives. This is a Rhode Island story. So I don't have a website yet, but you can find me on Facebook and call your library and locally here and say, or in New England, say, hey, can you have that guy in the Latch Mount? Libraries talk to one another.
Yeah.
It's a vast and healthy network. And it's a one-hour PowerPoint presentation. I hate long programs.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing this great information with us. I think it's a really fascinating story, and I think our listeners are going to be interested to hear more.
Well, Amy, thank you. I thought your questions were particularly good in terms of bringing out the meat of the story, so I appreciate the interview and you making it easy for me.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Ship History Radio from the Steamship Historical Society of America. We hope you enjoyed hearing about the Larchmont disaster with Daniel Harrington. You can learn more about our podcast by visiting shiphistory.org/radio, and to learn more about our organization, visit sshsa.org.